things are looking pretty good for the White Sox. And really, the AL Central divisional race as a whole is looking like it may be this way for the rest of the season. I am Mario Scalise. He is Jason Gage. This is the Southside Report. No longer Sox Talk on the air. It's the second week that we're doing it under the new name. And Jason, things are actually looking better for the White Sox this past week. Yes?
Yeah, it turns out that after going 0-2 against Cleveland, giving up all those runs, that the season was not over. Who would have thought it? Two games in, fans writing off all the chances. Who would have thought it wasn't really the case?
Yeah, I know, because usually two games into the season really does dictate how a team's going to do for the remainder of the season, but wasn't the case. And we're actually going to start with the early part of the week and going all the way back to Sunday, talking about John Danks. Now, we don't get too much into him because we're recording on a Saturday. He's going to be pitching in really just a few hours. But first impression, and I don't like to jump the gun when it comes to pitchers and young guys and how they'll fare throughout their career and throughout a season. But looking at John Danks on Sunday and looking at Nick Massette coming from the bullpen, I am very, very confident as of right now concerning that trade with Brandon McCarthy.
Yeah, that trade on paper, if there was going to be a team that stole that trade, it would have been the Chicago White Sox because they got more quality arms in the sense that Danks and McCarthy are similar prospects on the rating scale. And McCarthy did have a better second start after getting hit up his first start, having a terrible spring training. And while I don't think that people should necessarily look at McCarthy and Danks and be like, oh, if McCarthy does great, it's a terrible move. Although, the reality is, you know, if McCarthy does great and Danks was terrible, it would be a terrible move, and vice versa, yeah, for the Rangers fans' perspective. You just got to look at the fact that Danks, in his first start, wasn't afraid. And I think, aside from that...
Especially after that home run. Morneau home run, he settled in very nicely right after.
It was great to see him rebound. He went out and he threw strikes, even though he didn't have the best command, especially early on in that game. He battled through, but he showed that the Twins hitters really couldn't square him up, and that was on a day where he was not getting his off-speed stuff consistently over. And that impressed me a lot. If he can get guys out with his fastball, and if they get ground ball outs, and they really don't ever hit the ball very hard, aside from Morneau, who hit it a mile, you know, that's a good sign, especially because he has a good curveball. He's got a developing changeup that's getting better, and if he's flashing those, it's going to make him a lot tougher to hit, and it's going to be interesting to see how he does and how he progresses these next few starts, because it's too early to really put a prognosis on whether he's going to stick at the major league level.
Yeah.
But you had to like what you saw out of the kid in his first start.
I was pretty intrigued by his delivery. It was a little bit too active for me. I don't like the guys who kind of jump around a little too much, but he seemed to still be under control at the same time, and he almost kind of had like a Santana to him where he threw a lot of body at you, but he had that changeup where it got him off balance just enough. Now, speaking of Santana, Johan Santana, who is arguably, and actually I don't think anybody could argue, he is the best pitcher in Major League Baseball, at least as of right now. He has been killing the Sox now for about 2-3 years. You can maybe even go longer than that. And it happened again on Sunday. He beat them pretty easily. Is there a way to actually beat him? You know, last year the White Sox and Ozzie Guillen, they went with the all right-handed hitter approach, where they threw all these right-handers at him, thinking maybe that's going to do it. This year it seems like they're kind of laying off that a little bit, and I think even Pruszynski might even have got a start against him, and you know, I think Erced was still in the lineup, so it seems like he's trying to mix it up. Is there an actual way to maybe not hit him up and light him up, but at least score something off him?
Yeah, I definitely think there's a way. I mean, you see teams that have success against Santana. The problem is most of the teams that have success against Santana don't play him on a consistent basis. And when it comes to Santana, I think the biggest problem, not the fact that he's a great pitcher, it's the fact that he is completely inside the minds of the Chicago White Sox. I mean, he has them completely fooled. They just go up there thinking they have no chance. And if you do anything, I think any person knows if they're not confident about something, they're going to struggle at it. I mean, for me, yesterday, for example, I play soccer in a league twice a week, in a pretty good league. We have some competitive players. We have some people that play, you know, that played college soccer and were actually collegiate All-Americans, and you have me playing goalie because our team sometimes decides not to show up. And for me, I had no confidence, never playing goalie a day in my life. And no, I didn't succeed. I gave up four goals in the first, like, 15 minutes. It was an embarrassing predicament, and it's because I wasn't confident. And while that's in rec league soccer, it's no different for a major league ball player. And when a major league batter is going up, they're going, oh, shit, just let me make contact. You're not going to do good.
And I think that's even more so when you're dealing with a guy like Santana, who is more or less just a fastball changeup pitcher. Because when a guy is throwing a fastball changeup and he's doing a very good job of it, I think that could screw up a hitter's mind even more, because it's not like he's just fooling you with just nasty stuff. It's just that delivery. It's that motion. It's, you know, thinking a changeup's coming and being blown away by while a good fastball, not an overpowering fastball. And while, you know, you may be sitting on that fastball, you find yourself way out in front swinging at a changeup. So I think that mental game, I think you're right. I think the mental game is very, very big for the White Sox. And I who knows? Who really knows if there's ever really a philosophy, at least from the White Sox standpoint? I think the key is, I think they have to go in there, and this is not easy, it's easier said than done, but I think they have to go there and they have to try to sit on one of his pitches and just not let off it. And it may look ugly for him, and Santana may very well adjust to it, but I think they just have to go into one of these games and just sit on something. And you may look ridiculous some swings, but maybe a couple, you get some guys on base and something could happen from it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I actually think Hawk and DJ, I know they've consistently talked about the fact that the batter's got to go up there and be willing to swing early on in the counts, because when you face good pitchers, the last thing you want to do sometimes is actually go deep in the count, even though you like to see guys work the count, because it means if that pitcher's on, you may be able to get him out of the game earlier, because their pitch count may go up. And sometimes the best way to get to a guy like Johan Santana would be to get him out of the game in the sixth inning, because he's throwing 110 pitches.
Usually with the great pitchers, the longer you go into at bat, the worse off you are, because they have so many pitchers they could go to, and they're so smart on that mound that they're going to be able to probably beat you at the end. Whereas with a younger pitcher, or maybe a not as talented pitcher, you could see a lot of their stuff, and eventually they're going to make that mistake. A guy like Santana, not likely. So if you hit him early, when he's more likely to throw strikes, go across the plate, similar to like a Burley, if he's going to be throwing strikes early in that count to get ahead of you, you could potentially find some pitches to you know, get on base and potentially maybe make some things happen on the bases. Let's move on with rotation of the White Sox, because it has made some significant progress. You know, John Danks pitched very solid on Sunday. Then came the, Monday, when they played the Oakland A's. Jose Contreras came back after getting lit up in the opening day start against the Indians, and he pitched very well. Now, kind of an off story to that is there's been some talk that potentially the first game of the season, the opening day, he could have been lit up from things happening in his personal life with his family. Supposedly there was a report that came out, was it this past week, right?
Yep.
Saying that I think he paid somebody $200,000 roughly to, you remember when his family was brought over from Cuba, paid him $200,000 to go get his family and bring him to the States. And I guess that story may have came out, and I believe he may have, I know I even heard a rumor that he may have been getting a divorce with his wife. Nonetheless, there seems to be some family issues going around, and that potentially could have impacted his first start.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, obviously he wasn't there his first start, and I know I kind of ripped into Contreras more than he probably deserves, and part of it's because I hear so many people rave about how great of a pitcher he is from time to time.
Yeah.
And he pitched very good. He struggled early on in that game. He kind of got lucky through it. He didn't have his ace stuff. But he started to get a little bit more confidence as that game went on, after Don Cooper, one of the premier pitching coaches in all of baseball. I continue to say that because I hear Sox fans complain about Don Cooper, and I tell you, they don't know how good they got it with Coop. He went out there, he talked to Contreras. Contreras got aggressive with his fastball. He stopped throwing those 3-2 breaking balls to Jack McDowell, and it was a pleasure to have Jack McDowell in the booth, because he's a smart guy. He was a very good pitcher, and pitchers have that extra knowledge, pitchers and catchers, when it comes to the game of baseball. And Contreras really started to look like the pitcher that won 17 games in a row for the Sox at one point, you know, over two seasons, over the 05 and 06 season. He started to look good, started to get some rhythm. But I want to go to this off-the-field issue. First off, the guy has, you know, he got paid very well from the Yankees when he came over. He loves his family very much. Wouldn't any normal person, sane person, do everything they could to get their family over here from Cuba?
You would do it. I would do it.
Nothing.
anybody would do it, and somebody says they wouldn't, they could very well be lying. I think most likely they're lying. Yeah, you can't really fault him for that, even though he could be in some legal trouble with it, which who knows how exactly that works out for the Sox.
Yeah, I don't know the legal ramifications of any of this, but I assume that once you leave Cuba, since he's here on a work visa, his family can be here, I assume there's something along those lines. Because I know major league players, you know, they find a way to, you know, they get here, and so many guys have done it. And Contreras had to get here. And when you make $10 million or $7, $8 million a year, whatever you made with the Yankees, it's not that big of a deal to spend $200,000 to get your family. I mean, I think you have a lot of people that make $60,000 a year, and if their only option was to get their family.
If anything, he should have paid more.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't see any reason that this guy should worry about that. I would just say, if they're going to do something to me for my family, then you know what, so be it.
Yeah.
My family comes first and foremost in anything. And I think we'll hopefully see him get past that mental thinking about other stuff when he's on the baseball mound, and we'll see him get back to pitching better. And if he does, he can be key for the White Sox because he does have the ability to be an ace. I said he wasn't an ace,
yeah,
but he has the ability to stuff.
Well, I think the one thing about the Sox rotation is that they have four guys who at any given point could potentially be an ace. And I think sometimes that's a key. When you have a deep rotation, if one guy could be an ace of your staff for 1 month, in a rotation like the Sox, that's what they need. You know, whether it's a Garland or a Burley or Contreras, whatever, they all have the capabilities for at one point in the season stepping up and carrying that team. And I think that's more important, and that's kind of an advantage as opposed to some teams where you may just have one guy. Let's go into that third start of the series. We're going to get into the middle game, but that third game, Mark Burley, that's the game that they want to take that series against the Oakland A's. Coming back from, he got hit both, literally and actually both ways in that first start of the season. Got hit up in the first inning, actually got hit in the hand, in the forearm in the second inning, was pulled out of the game. Actually, at that given point, a lot of people were worried that he may be done for the season or for at least a very long time. He ends up recovering just like he did, I think it was last spring training when, or even maybe 2005, where he had that kind of scare in spring training, thought he was going to be out for a while. He ended up coming back and making his next start. He did make his next start, struggled in the first inning again. I think he gave up two or three runs, and then came back and threw, what is it, seven innings?
Yeah, he had a very good outing. And for Mark Burley, there was nothing more important than in his first actual full start, because I don't think you can count a start where he got hit by a pitch, that he actually came out and he had some success.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just huge.
And really, in that game, Sizemore led off with the home run, and then that pretty much, after he gave up those runs, I think he got the outs to finish that inning, and then he came in and he got the first out of the second inning. So it seemed like he was finally about to get back on track. Now, let's get into the middle part of that game. John Garland, he pitched very, very well. We're not going to talk about Garland, though. The later part of that game, they had a one-run lead. Bobby Jenks came into the game, had no velocity, was throwing about 93, 94, you know, had some decent breaking pitches, but was throwing 93, 94. And whenever you're doing that, a guy like Mike Piazza, who's getting up there in age, is able to pull a ball and hit it to the left side through the infield. That's not really a good sign of how that inning was going to play out. And sure enough, he ended up blowing that lead. Are you at all concerned at this point about Bobby Jenks?
No, but I'm in the minority. And I mean, even Ozzie Guillen, he made some quotes after yesterday's game that there is some concern about the fact that Jenks doesn't have his velocity. But my theory is that Bobby Jenks has the plus breaking pitches, that if he works and he gets good command of those, and he's had a much better command of this season, that he still has all the stuff to succeed and excel as one of the premier closers in the game. Although, having a 97, 98 mile an hour fastball is a lot better than having a 92, 93 mile an hour fastball, because it means your breaking balls are going to have a little bit more variety and gap and speed.
Yeah.
In this case, a guy could be in between and end up still getting a hit. And that's not really the case when he's throwing 97, 98. And obviously, it's something the Sox fans should, and the Sox should be concerned about, because is there an underlying issue to why his velocity is low? If his velocity, I think it'll be key to watch the next 2 to 3 weeks and see if his velocity climbs.
Mm-hmm.
If it does, I wouldn't be concerned at all, because he's typically been a little bit more of a slow starter. But some people have pointed out the fact that last season at this time, he was throwing in the mid-90s. So obviously, he should be a little bit.
Yeah. And I think even more concerning is, especially if the velocity, if you kind of know come July his velocity is going to be up there, he came back that second game, and he ended up picking up that save, which was kind of surprising considering I think he threw a few pitches in that second game against the A's. So I didn't know if he was necessarily going to come back the next day, but he did, and he seemed like he was trying to throw a cutter a little bit more, trying to stay off speed, kept the ball down. And that cutter, it could potentially cause more problems for him, because while it could get him out of a lot of trouble, because it has a lot more movement, obviously, naturally, you wonder if that could potentially do some more damage to his arm trying to throw it over and over again, to where maybe later on, even when he has his velocity back, he could potentially have a serious injury on his hands.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, he's had a cutter. He doesn't throw it too often, but it's a pitch he's always had in his arsenal. And I think the main thing is you don't get too happy throwing that cutter. Like in Esteban Loaiza, just really started to rely completely on the cutter. His velocity dropped because of it, mm-hmm. and he ended up having some arm problems and other problems also with his health. But Jenks is a guy that, while I think you should be on the radar and looking at him, he's the type of guy that if he doesn't have his plus velocity, as long as he's healthy, and if he can improve his command of his breaking stuff, he still has enough plus pitches to succeed with a lower fastball that maybe tops out at 94. Although, that may not be the case. It's still early. It's early to say, and we got to see what happens with his velocity. Because I know a National League scout or some scout, I saw this in the Tribune, said that his velocity is up to 95, which is 2 or 3 mile an hour harder than he was throwing a week or two ago.
I guess just a wait and see. Luckily, the rest of the bullpen has stepped up and has at least been able to get him the ball in the ninth inning and give him a chance to put the team down. Now, let's get into sticking with that game, because Bobby Jenks wasn't all at fault in the last inning. While he takes the majority of that fall because he put a lot of those guys in base and he was giving up that hit, in that ninth inning, with a one-run lead, Scott Pitsenik was out in left field. Of course, he's been the starter, and he's been doing very well offensively, which we'll talk about. But he was out there in left field. Darren Erstad was out there in center field. And there you have Brian Anderson, a very good defensive center fielder, good defensive outfielder, sitting on the bench. And because of that, you had a play at the plate, which a ball hit the left field. I'm not sure who was running. I think Bradley. I think it was Bradley. I think he was running home. Ends up testing Pitsenik. Pitsenik airmails it, throws it over the head of A.J. Pierzynski, ends up scoring the tying run. And then on the very next play, with two outs, he's playing shallow. Ball's hit over his head. He gets back there rather quickly. He uses speed to get back there, but jumps, lands on the ground, and the ball looks like it hits him in the head, or at least in the back. A play that, it wasn't a routine play, but it was a play that you would assume an average outfielder would have made, an outfielder like a Darren Erstad or Brian Anderson. Did Guillen make a big mistake, or is he going to continue making this big mistake with having Scott Pitsenik in the late innings in a close ball game?
If the White Sox are winning, you need to have your defense out there to protect the lead. There's no doubt, there's no myth to that, especially in the ninth inning of a ball game. You need to have your defense out there, because you know what? You play to win. You don't play for the tie. You don't play to lose. You play to win. And the best way for you to win is to have your best defense out in the field, especially in the last inning. And Brian Anderson would be that. Whether that means Erstad moves to left field, probably not, because he's been playing center field all game. But you would play Brian Anderson out there, and Brian Anderson would make that play 9 times out of 10. Scott Pitsenik, and I've consistently said this, is the worst defensive left fielder in all of baseball. There's no way around it. Manny Ramirez can throw guys out. Scott Pitsenik can't catch the ball. He's terrible going back on the ball, and he can't throw anyone out. As the Cleveland Indians announcer said yesterday, this guy has absolutely no arm. Everyone in baseball knows it. You were stupid not to run. Benji Molina may be sent on a ground ball if he's on second base, if it's weakly enough hit. There's just no reason. There's nothing logical.
Yeah, the only time I could see in a one-run game, I'm only assuming one-run game, I think maybe in a three-run game, maybe you could have, actually in that case, you maybe want to pull him out even more. The only logic I could see maybe in a one-run game is if Pitsenik set to lead off the next inning. I think if he's maybe set to lead off the next inning, maybe you could be okay with it, because then you're still putting the ball in the hands of Bobby Jenks, and you're hoping Bobby Jenks doesn't get guys on base and makes it easy outs. Because really, even though that play should have been made, it was still hit over his head. It was still hit very hard. It was still hit on back-to-back curveballs to, was it Todd Walker? Was he the one who got that hit? Who was one? No, not Todd Walker. I'm sorry. It was Mark Ellis who got that game.
Yeah, Mark Ellis.
It was back-to-back curveball. It was still Bobby Jenks who made the mistakes to let the ball hit that deep. But you're right. You still want your best defense out there. And like I said, I think the only time maybe you don't do it is if Pecenik is maybe set to lead off the next inning and you want to kind of just have that kind of backup plan in case something does go wrong. But Scott Pecenik offensively, defensively he's been, you know, mediocre or in your case, very, very bad. Or at least that game he was. But offensively, he's been a pleasant surprise. And in fact, he's probably been one of their best offensive players so far. Although that's not saying much considering how many guys are struggling. But Scott Pecenik has done good. I think he's batting .300. He's getting on base. He still, I think he stole 3 stolen bases to 2 caught stealing. So that's still an issue because if you're stealing 40 bases and you're getting caught 20 times, that's not an ideal situation. But he is producing better offensively, and that's got to be somewhat of a surprise because now you kind of wonder how much more time he's bought himself if he does go into another slump.
There's no doubt he's bought himself time, and while I've slammed Pecenik's defense, I will tell you, despite that play, he has played better defensively from the perspective of getting the balls. He's getting better jumps this season because last year he was horrendous getting jumps, and I'm willing to say that. He's made improvements in that area. He will never be able to throw guys out. He just doesn't have the arm. Johnny Damon doesn't have the arm. You know, it's something that guys know. And if you can play around, if Pecenik plays at the plate like he's been doing, he's fine because, let's be honest, having a good leadoff hitter matters. I remember all the years when Ray Durham was on the Sox, and when Ray Durham went, so did the White Sox.
Yes.
Now, to a lesser extent, we can say that about Pecenik because I think it's more of, as the starting pitching goes, so go the White Sox because they, even when they don't have good offense, which has not been the case, they've still now are 5-4 and over .500. But Pecenik has taken pitches, drawn walks. He's done a very good job of that over his career since coming to the White Sox when it comes to being what a leadoff hitter should do and take pitches and do his best to get on base. And if he can hit for a .280 to more like .290 average, he will have a good on-base percentage. And while he got thrown out twice by Victor Martinez, he's actually made some strides when it comes to stolen bases, and he looks a lot better than he did last year. Frankly, he looks healthy, and it gives me some optimism, as much as I dislike Pecenik as a player. It gives me some optimism to the fact that he may end up doing all right for the Sox, and he may end up being a valuable asset at the top of that lineup.
There's been a couple instances. I remember that game, the game last week, he was on second base, and was on the mound? Forgot the guy's name. That's kind of sad, but he was on second base, and a pickoff, actually, it was the Minnesota Twins reliever, the hefty set left-hander. Reyes, I believe his name is. And he tried to make the, I think he was trying to pick off Scott Pecenik off second base, ends up throwing into center field. Scott Pecenik goes from second to home plate. I think stuff like that, especially if the Sox pitching staff is good, I think a guy like that who makes that impact in those close one-run games, I think that's what's kind of key. You know, you had that issue where I think Juan Uribe hits a home run. The very next pitch, you know, actually that same game, Scott Pecenik bunts, has a bunt single. I think having that element to the White Sox is very, very important, especially if the middle of the lineup guys are struggling and getting a little bit too power happy. So I think Scott Pecenik is obviously very key, as most leadoffs are and leadoff men are, and I think that could it's a good sign for him to start off well because maybe the other year theory works for him. Maybe he's just an odd year player where, you know, he's going to play well this year. Maybe the Sox could trade him after this season and get him back for 2008. Who knows? Or 2009. Who knows what the case may be? One guy who's batting right in front of him, who's also been playing very well, has been Juan Uribe. He's also batting over .300. He had a game Friday in which he had 4 RBIs, a sacrifice fly, which he does so well at. If there's probably one guy in the team with a man at third base and one out that I want up, it's probably him because you know he's going to be able to lift the ball to the outfield. And then, of course, he had that 3-run homer. He's been rather impressive, even though it seems like he's just hot right now and you kind of wonder if he's going to take the same approach going the rest of the season. But he does seem a little bit more patient and he does seem to be taking better swings.
Yeah, Juan Uribe has been very impressive. He worked hard. He's saying all the right things. He's saying he's working on stuff. He's just really working hard at the plate. He's working hard in practice during batting practice and just with Greg Walker in general. And you got to be impressed. The guy is up there, and he's having good at-bats. He's not just giving away at-bats. We all know he's strong. he has the tools to hit for a very, very well pitch. He can hit for power. He can hit a ton of doubles. And he could hit be a decent average hitter. And the reality is, this guy's looking like a whole new player. And that is huge for the White Sox, because if you have that type of turnover in the back of the lineup, and if Tadahito Iguchi can start hitting, that drastically changes this team from what it was last year. When last year, you had the middle of the lineup just thumped. You had the top of the order was bad. And you had the back of the order that was bad with Brian Anderson, Juan Uribe, and Pesednik kind of rolling all into one. And this year, if you have Pesednik possibly hitting, Erstad, we'll see what happens with Erstad, but I think he'll hit pretty decent when he's out there, even though he's been in a little bit of a slump. And he will move guys over, and he'll do all those things that are necessary that help you win one-run ball games. And then you turn to the back of the lineup where you have Iguchi and Uribe actually hitting. That's just a whole new offense. That's an offense that's capable of putting up crooked numbers, no matter who's the trio that's going to start the inning.
And the one
that's
thing,
positive.
And the one thing that's nice is that Scott Pecenik, as bad as he may be, he does do a pretty good job of producing runs when guys are on base. He did it last year. I think he had 45 RBIs, considering he had two guys in front of him who were just horrendous. I think a nice potential sign of things to come with Uribe, though, is going to Friday's game where, you know, Tadayu Taguchi's batting. He swings that absolute junk, strikes out, and here comes Juan Uribe to the plate and takes the first three pitches for balls. And that's just something you don't see Juan Uribe do. But when he does do it, you know that he's being patient up there, he's being relaxed, and he's waiting for the pitch to come. And I think the next pitch was either the home run or that deep fly out to left field. So hopefully he's taking that patience and he's going up to the plate, not looking to just swing at everything. And if he does, as a ninth hitter, he could be probably one of the better. He has the potential to be one of the better ninth hitters in all of baseball.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I'm going to finish with just the key to Uribe is for him not to take this start and get crazy happy and lose his approach. He's got to stay within himself. And if he can do that, he can have this and prolong the success and maybe turn into this type of player for the rest of his career.
And you know, obviously, defensively, going back to Friday's game, he struggled big time, but that's like a one in a million type thing with Juan Uribe, because he's going to bring you defense pretty much every single day. And every once in a while, he might have a little mental lapse, but for the most part, he's going to improve, and you know he's going to recover from that game. If he produces this year, that's going to be a very, very big thing. And like you said, I think the big concern is him getting a little bit too happy and trying to pull the ball a little bit too much and trying to be a little bit too aggressive up there, thinking that he's going to always get that big hit. He's got to still stay patient. He's still got to wait for his pitch. Now, going to that, we're going to take a break soon, but going to the bench, and a very kind of surprising, nice story is Toby Hall. Spring training, he injures his shoulder while playing first base, which some people seem to flip out about, even though I think that's how stuff like that happens. He's recovering very, very well from the injury. I think he was throwing yesterday, or he was throwing one of these last couple days, and it's a 50-50 chance that he's going to return, I think, in the next month or so. That's a big stride, considering when this injury happened, there was talks that he was going to be out for the entire season.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. It's pretty amazing when you really think about it. I mean, this is a guy that tore his labrum. I remember when Frank Thomas tore his labrum. I remember when John Roush tore his labrum. I remember when Jim Parquet tore his labrum. And then there was Mike Soroka, who got traded, who tore his labrum. I think all those guys had labrum issues. And here's Toby Hall, who's pretty much, you know, a month removed. Not even a month removed. 3 weeks removed or so. From tearing his labrum, dislocating his shoulder, and he's already throwing a baseball.
That's got to say, that says a lot about his character.
Yeah, and basically Herm Schneider said the reality is this guy will be able to play as long as he can handle enough of the pain, because I don't think he's ever going to be able to throw without pain. And it'll be interesting to see. I think the true dilemma is going to be when he's behind the plate, are guys just going to run all day long on him? If that's the case, are we going to have like what the Washington Nationals had a year ago with Matt LaCroix when they stole like 18 stolen bases in a game?
I don't see Isaac Ian crying, though.
I don't know. I would cry because if Toby Hall had worked that hard and came back and...
The good thing is that Przinsky's going to get the chunk of time. And you know what? Even when Przinsky's out there, he doesn't have much of an arm to begin with. Granted, last year a lot of that had to do with Jose Contreras and Freddy Garcia having absolutely no ability to actually holding guys on base. But the good thing is that he's not going to be out there every day. So if he can kind of just suck it up maybe every 4 or 5 days and just grind his teeth when he's throwing it, that might work. Is this like a long-term injury? Is this something that he'll always have, or is this just a recovery thing?
Well, this is where I'm not too clear. I'm not a doctor, but I'd imagine that they're trying to rehab it to where he's at this point. And I don't know if it's just because he's not a pitcher, they may think that he can rehab it, and as long as he can handle the pain, it'll always be there type deal. Or if it's to the point where they're going to rehab it, get him to play now, and then in the offseason he'll have the surgery and then come back next year.
Okay.
Because as a catcher, you'd have a little bit shorter since you're not pitching on a consistent basis. I'm not sure how that prognosis works. And I guess it's going to be the Sasha going to see where he is in May or June, and if it's not the case, I'd imagine they'd shut him down, he'd have his surgery, and he'd be healthy for next year.
And really, the big thing with Toby Hall, I think, when he came here is just the fact that he is a good hitter, and he was a productive hitter with the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. They figure he's going to come in as a right-handed hitter to replace a Brzezinski when they're facing guys like Santana, when they're facing guys like CC Sabathia and Nate Robertson or whoever lefties they may be facing within that division, and being that right-handed hitter off the bench to replace him. So I think if he can at least come back to at least be a productive hitter and kind of hold his own defensively, I think they'll be fine with that.
Yeah, they'll be much better off because, let's be honest, that's better than Gustavo Molina, who actually did a good job. Burley raved about him as a catcher.
Yeah.
But Burley raves about a lot of guys as catchers, you know.
Yeah.
He's the type of guy that's going to go out there, and as long as he locates his pitches, he's going to have a good game.
And really, Molina, you can't really fault him any struggles he had. He came in as really wasn't going to be catching. Toby Hall was going to be the third string, so he was kind of put into an awkward situation. But he hasn't really been playing much. That was his first game. Przinski's carrying much of the load, which kind of makes you think that they do feel Toby Hall is going to be back, because if it was clear that Toby Hall was going to be gone the rest of the season and Molina was going to be their guy for the entire season, you would think he would have gotten a couple more starts, because you have to get him starts eventually. So it appears that the Sox know he's going to come back and or at least are planning on him coming back and being a productive backup catcher.
I think the plan is if he can't come back, they'll make a trade at that point.
Yeah.
Like I said, they'll pick up a backup.
Let's head to a break, I think. We're going to come back, and we have a special segment as Alex Ernst. He was on the show last week. He's going to be in the show. He's going to be on here with you. You're going to talk about the White Sox minor leagues.
Yep.
Is it the Future Sox Report? That'll be officially, I think, what we call it.
Yeah, the Future Sox Report. That's right, guys. We're getting actually professional on this show. Who the hell would have thought it?
It's coming professional. Up. And it's coming up next. This week.
Back to the brand new version of the Southside Report. You heard our first show last week. You heard our first segment. That's right. We are doing segments. And now in our second segment, I am Jason Gage. But with me is the man, the myth, the legend, Alex Ernst. Alex, good to have you here. It's good to be able to talk some more future Southside news on the farm system, guys, on the minor leaguers, on the future of this franchise.
You just said you were Jason Gage, and I just enjoy every day of my life waking up knowing I'm not Jason Gage.
You know, and I enjoy every day I wake up, and I look in the mirror, and I go, God, whew, look at that. You're a five-tool prospect. Five-tool.
The only tool of yours that I know of is your hair, and that's just because you throw so much gel in there.
It's amazing that you know that from a radio show, but I got to dress up and look good when I'm on the radio. How do I know we don't have a video feed here?
Well, how's my tie look?
Steadily. Very steadily. It brings out the color of your eyes.
Let's just move on to baseball.
Yeah, it's probably better that way.
Yeah. Anyways, well, the minor league teams have been starting play this last week, and for once, there's actually been some encouraging signs. Mainly, if you look down in Double A, you look at Birmingham, and if you look at their pitching staff, you'll notice one guy with an ERA under 3, or over 3, and that's Carlos Vasquez with a 4.5 ERA. What do you think so far? Because all of a sudden it looks like our Barons rotation's filled with prospects. You've got Jack Egbert, who's 2-0 with a 1.5 ERA, Wes Whistler, who's got a 1.69 ERA, Gio Gonzalez with a 1.74 ERA, and Adam Russell, you know, he's the high man on the totem pole with that 2.45 ERA. It's crazy to look down there and see, hey, we've got guys who, you know, might actually come up and make a difference in our rotation someday.
I think the more ridiculous part when you look at that is you have three starters in Jack Egbert, Adam Russell, and Gio Gonzalez that have more strikeouts than any pitches, and it's only two starts into the season. You have, you look there, and all these guys have low whips. I mean, it is ridiculous what's going on down there in Birmingham, that pitching. Egbert, 17 strikeouts, 12 innings. Adam Russell, we all got to see him a bit in spring training in that mid-90s fastball, the multiple arm angles. And he's built like a pitcher. He's built like a frontline pitcher when you talk about 6'5", 6'6", presence. You got Gio, a little bit smaller, more petite frame, but he's got 15 Ks in 10 innings, only giving up 6 hits. I mean, him and Egbert have been just unhittable, making everyone else look like amateurs with their mid-2 ERAs. Whistler is starting to look why he was that first-round draft pick. I mean, this is a good team, and this is a good system. It's amazing. Baseball America should rate the White Sox organization 25th more often, because there is no way this is the 25th best organization in baseball. All the moves, and they were late moves, so some of those moves didn't come into effect in the Baseball America ratings. But this system is definitely top 15, and with all this pitching depth, I'm very impressed. I'm actually getting excited about the White Sox farm systems and what the job that they've done.
Well, possibly one of the best stories about Birmingham is you look at the stats and you see the one guy who's on top, and you see Chris Honel, who's finally, is he back? In one start, he went 6 innings and gave up just 2 hits. And from what I heard, his velocity is not quite back up there yet, but, you know, he builds a lot of the stuff off of that knuckle curve that was one of his best pitches before he got hurt. And if he can come back and start, you know, having some more good outings, I think the ship might have kind of sailed on him as a starter. Unless he can just, you know, kind of put his crap back together. But it kind of looks like, you know, one day he could be in AAA even this year if what we saw out of his first start is something that he can keep putting together. But it doesn't look like now that he's going to be a career minor leaguer anymore if in fact, this first start is any indication.
Well, I think y'all got we still got to remember to step back and look at Honel as it is. Honel was, you know, he was highly touted when he first came up. And I know that I was one of the few people that kind of said there's still some question marks to this guy, because his knuckle curveball is great, but he took advantage of that knuckle curveball a lot in the lower levels, and you're going to get a lot more guys to swing at pitches that aren't strikes when you're in the lower levels and when you start moving up in the system. But what obviously bothered him, and what pretty much ruined his career in terms of a prospect for a long time, and maybe he will reemerge as a prospect, was all his arm injuries, his velocity, which was once in the low 90s, topping out about 90, 91 mile an hour. It dropped down about 83, 84 mile an hour. And in his first outing, from everything I've read and seen, it sounded like he was in the mid-80s, which is an improvement. And you also have to understand, when you've been out of baseball as long as he has, or not been able to consistently pitch as long as he is, there's going to be an adjustment period to regain velocity. And I think the key will be a month and a half from now, seeing if his velocity is up to like an 87, 80 to 89 mile an hour range, where if he can throw that hard, and his knuckle curve back from what I've heard, is back to having that nasty bite, and it was once, you know, one of the premier breaking pitches in the Sox organization, then yeah, he does have the two pitches. If he has a good enough, decent enough fastball, he'd have the two pitches to have some success as a reliever, potentially at the major league level, but I think it's still far too early to get excited about Honel. But it's just great that he's out there and he had a good start, because for his confidence that was very low for a long time, this is just huge for him.
All right, now, the one last guy I wanted to look at on the Birmingham pitching staff was Duan Day. The guy has 3 saves, and in 3 2/3 innings, he has 1 walk and 10 strikeouts. I know you're higher on him than a lot of guys. You know, he was a Rule 5 pickup 2 years ago, I think. But there's a lot of people starting to think that, hey, this guy will be in Charlotte at some point this year, and he could possibly 40-man roster, make the Sox bullpen.
Yeah, I think that Day is a name people should get familiar with. He's older. He's 25 or 26 years old. And while he's a Rule 5 draft pick, he was a minor league Rule 5 draft pick, so he's not the type that had to stay up on the major league roster, so he didn't have his development shortened there. He, if I recall, he had a little bit of injury arm problems, so he's been a late bloomer. But his slider rate's, you know, a 60 to 70 on the scout scale, and at times it's a 70, which is pretty much one away, because an 80 is technically, like, off the charts, like a Mariano Rivera cutter or two-seamer.
Yeah.
And then you have, you know, the 70, which is a real good pitch. When you throw a 70 and it's a slider, that gives you a plus off-speed pitch. He throws a mid-90s fastball. This guy is good, and he's starting to come around. He's starting to get better command of his pitches, and he's just got to get a little bit more faith in that fastball and not rely totally on the slider, and he's starting to do that. And he's going to be a guy that can move quickly up into Charlotte if Charlotte needs him, if the White Sox want to get him up there. And if anyone stumbles from the right side of that pen, I don't think it's Gavin Floyd they look to. I think it's DeJuan Day, because his upside is tremendous.
And you know, while we're in Birmingham, all of a sudden they look like they're holding a bunch of our prospects. There's three guys I wanted to single out on the team, and that's Donnie Lucy, who knew we had a catching prospect. He's got 6 doubles so far in 7 games, and he's hitting .429 with an OPS over 1,200. Christopher Getz, who we just interviewed for Future Sox, is hitting .324 with an OPS over 1,000. And Robert Melito, who we talked about his ability and we bantered back and forth, and you see him just sitting at the bottom of the Barron's stat sheet with an .061 average. It's depressing at one point to see Melito doing so badly, but it's also, when you see Getz doing that well, it's nice to think we might have a prospect at second base if you know, Iguchi leaves after this year.
Yeah, and I think Getz is going to make that push. He's going to do whatever he can to at least try to make the Sox think twice when it comes to the Iguchi. And if Iguchi goes somewhere else, they may think twice and say, hey, we may have an in-house candidate that we can try first. Or if he fails, we can use our depth in prospects and go get another second baseman. So they may not panic on that and have to go out and get a big bat if Iguchi leaves. And Iguchi, if he stays down in the lineup the whole season, it gives you a little bit more freedom. I mean, if Iguchi was going to be consistently in the 2 spot, that's a lot harder to let that guy go away and let a new guy come up and develop in a season. But Getz is going to have to make a lot of noise, and he's going to have to play very good and up to his maximum ability in Birmingham and maybe later on in Charlotte if that's going to happen, just to open up those eyes. But I think the guy I want to key in on is Donnie Lucy. This guy was a high draft pick by the White Sox. You had guys like Kurt Suzuki. There's been some discussion of that on Sox Talk lately. You had Suzuki, who was a catcher out of Cal State Fullerton, my alma mater, and that guy could hit. He was a leader. He'd proven that he knew how to play in the collegiate level. His tools projected nicely in major league level, and the Sox passed on him to get a guy like Lucy, who didn't have as much experience. He was at Stanford. Stanford is a top-notch program, just like Fullerton, and he was stuck behind Ryan Garko, so that limited his development early on in college. And then he had some decent years as a junior there at Stanford. But the reality of the situation was he wasn't as good of a collegiate player. However, the guy is a phenomenal athlete. He has all the tools that you really rave about when you look for a top-notch catcher. He has a very strong arm, quick release. He's good behind the plate. He's very quick. He's a good athlete, so he can block pitches. And his tools progressed to where he could be a solid hitter, but his swing's never quite developed. He's never quite got there. He's always been a little bit behind on the scale, so to speak. And this year, he's starting to maybe, at least going out to some early signs, he's got a good gap power. He's never going to hit you 25 home runs, but he has the type of ability and strength to at least hit 15 to 20 if he can develop a bit more, and he could be that type of late bloomer. And catchers, in reality, catchers tend to be late bloomers because you have so much work and so much focus early on in career when it comes to handling the pitching staffs and working on blocking pitches, working on throwing a second, because hitting is a secondary, you know. It's not quite the priority. When it comes to catching, you got to be able to play defense and call a good game first.
And then finally, when we were talking about Valido, it's kind of a sad story. Ever since he had that suspension for a performing-enhancing substance, he's just never been the same. And I know Kenny Williams and Ozzie Guillen expected a lot out of him, and especially when he came into spring training in 2006. They're like, hey, this guy's the future at shortstop. And they wanted this to be his job. They wanted him to be in the middle infield probably by next year. But even though Birmingham's a really tough place to play, the fact that he's starting the season hitting below 100, an on-base below 100, and a slugging below 100, it can't be good for him. I mean, you know, some people are just going to start off the year in a tough spot, and I mean, we've seen that with, like, A.J. Pierzynski on the major league roster, but it's sort of depressing to see the one guy who I think he was as high as number four on our top 25 list just get off to such a crappy start.
Yeah, it's disappointing because it's spring training when he comes into those major league games. He looks ready. He looks prepared. He looks like he has a plan at the plate, and you don't see many young players do that. And it makes you think when you see him in those, you know, microcosms that he's going to be a very good player. But the reality is he just hasn't put up the numbers. He hasn't excelled enough at the minor league level as of late to do so. And I don't know if it's lacking of confidence or if he lacks focus when he's not trying to impress major league player, you know, major league players and Ozzie Guillen. But something's going on there that he's just got to get relaxed and get into a groove because he has a pretty smooth swing. He'll never hit 330 or anything like that. But he has enough of a swing to be a decent hitter. He has a great approach at the plate, so I don't know why he's striking out 11 times in 8 games. It just doesn't make sense. I know last year he did struggle with some injuries, and that was used kind of as the reason why he struggled. So it'll be interesting to see if he can rebound this year, because if he can't, you know, that's obviously when you start writing him off. And the Sox may look, I know Baseball America is projecting them to take the stop in the first round this year. And, you know, it wouldn't hurt you. The Sox definitely need some middle infield help, depth.
All right, I think we've talked enough about our Double-A team, but I figured, you know, we'd look really quick at Charlotte, and there's two guys that have really stood out to me so far. First of all, Casey Rogowski, who we thought we might be trading somewhere, you know, give him an opportunity somewhere, has just done beyond shitty so far with batting below 100, and I think he's been batting in the 3 or 4 hole most of the year. And the other guy is Luis Torreira, who I'm starting to think should be on the major league roster if Ryan Anderson's never going to play, because he's got 4 home runs already this year in just 1 week, and his OPS is above 1,100, and the fact that we know he can at least play all 3 outfield positions, and the fact that Ozzie likes him and wanted him on the team from all accounts, it's really possible that we could see him and Anderson flip-flop, allowing Anderson to get some starts in AAA, and Torreira to become the backup outfielder. Gaga.
I definitely think that's an option, but I think the Sox are going to be pretty careful about doing that just early on. I think they'll see what's going on with Anderson, and only Ozzie Guillen and the rest of the coaching staff kind of know where his head's at, if he's going to be able to handle this type of, you know, a little bit of a demotion. He's not going to be playing every day, and whether Anderson's happy with it too. I mean, you got to make sure Anderson's happy, and while I'm sure he's willing to do whatever the team wants him to do, at the same time, you know, it's tough going down to AAA, but it could be best for his career in the long term. But maybe just getting some time at the major league level and not having as much pressure could be the best thing for his career, because, you know, he had a lot of things going on in his head last year, especially as he continued to struggle, and pressure mount builds up. And when it's a World Series team, defending World Series champions, and the team's not doing as good, and a fan favorite like Aaron Rowan's left, you're going to have a lot of fans, and a lot of times those are the casual fans that are calling out for Anderson to be gone. Why do we ever trade Aaron Rowan? And that all builds up into a young player's head, especially as they're not doing good. And in Torreira's case, the Sox picked this guy up from Baltimore, and they saw that last season he made adjustments in his swing, and he was once pretty highly touted, it should be known. He made some adjustments in his swing, and he started raking at the minor league level, and he's just continued to rake ever since. And he's the type of guy that I know the White Sox actually are very high on and wouldn't mind to get him up there as a 4th or 5th outfielder if it's necessary.
Oh, what do you think about Charlotte's plan? Torreira was looked at as possibly being, you know, the backup center fielder this year, but they've got Sweeney in center field at this point in the year, and they've got Torreira in right. Do you think the Sox are trying to make it so that Sweeney is going to be the fallback in case Anderson can't get it done in center, that Sweeney will be the guy we're going to look towards in center?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about that. The White Sox long-term plan is for Brian Sweeney or Brian Anderson to play center field. I don't think they're trying to acquire anyone unless things get to the point where the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, who are loaded with potential leadoff hitters, decide to sell a guy on the low because they have a good contract as well to go with it. But I don't think the Devil Rays, they don't have a history of selling guys on the lows, so I don't think it's going to happen, even with their new GM. And Ken Williams is confident, and you know Ozzie Guillen likes Sweeney. He likes him a lot. And that's always a positive, because once you get in Guillen's doghouse, it is tough to get out of there. And Anderson has found himself squarely in that doghouse, and he's going to have to work extra hard and impress to come out of it. I mean, that's the reality of the situation.
All right. I think we're going to keep on moving down our ladder of the system and go to high A and look at Winston-Salem. And the one guy who's been performing way above, you know, what anyone really thought he could do, I mean, the ability's been there, but he's just been on fire so far this year, is Aaron Cunningham, and this guy's just been rocketing up the charts as far as a prospect in the Sox organization. He's hitting .444 right now, and I don't think it's impossible to see him being starting in AA by the All-Star break, just because he has that much talent, and we knew that when we drafted him. He's got most of the tools you want. He's got a good eye, and he can hit for a little power, and most of all, he can hit for contact. But he's one of the, I think he is the outfielder right now that is advancing the highest in the minds of the Sox brass as far as prospect status in the organization. What are your thoughts on Cunningham?
Yeah, Cunningham's still about a year short from being talked about a lot by a guy like Ken Williams, who usually doesn't start putting focus on his prospects from his standpoint, and he's the GM, so he's focused on other things until they reach AA, typically is the case. So I think that's when you'll start hearing a bit more from him, about him from the media and everyone else. But Cunningham's a very, very talented prospect. He just continues to move up the boards. He can hit for average. He can hit for a decent amount of power. He has good gap power, extra bases, pretty decent speed, a good outfield arm. He's pretty much a good all-around player. He would fit in nicely. He could be kind of that right fielder, grindy type player, just a good all-around guy. And I know grinding type player scares people away. It makes people think that the guy doesn't have any tools, but that's not the case with Cunningham. And he's right there, and this system is loaded with outfield talent, especially if you can Josh Field as a potential outfielder between Ryan Sweeney, Brian Anderson, Aaron Cunningham, and Josh Fields. You have a lot of ability there, and then you have a guy like Tom Calero in AA who can hit for a lot of power and has had a good start to the season. And, you know, it's very encouraging. Like I continue to say, I'm nothing but optimistic early on in the season. And, you know, it's just a microcosm. It's just 8 games. I mean, ask Sox fans what they thought 2 games into the season was over. Who would have thought they'd be a game over .500 right now?
Well, it's been that pitching getting its crap together, and that's really nice to see. But I think we'll move on now to the final team of the organization, and that's the Kannapolis Intimidators. And I know one of your favorites is down there, and he's hitting the crap out of the ball, and that's Chris Carter.
Yeah, Chris Carter is a guy that if there's any player in the Sox system that's currently down there, if I could see him being rated as a top 10, top 15 prospect in all of baseball, and this is obviously a lot of, you know, this is a lot of optimism, but with the skill set Carter has at the plate, you have that ability. I mean, he's the type of guy that could hit 40 to 45 home runs in the minor leagues without a doubt if he could, you know, if he hits minor league pitching. And that's always a big question mark. A lot of guys could do that if they hit minor league pitching. But Carter has just natural power, pure power, and that gets guys rated very high, even though he doesn't have defensive tools at all. I don't know where he's going to play, if it's first base, left field, wherever it may be. But if Carter can hit, and he's starting to hit, and he's hitting well in Kannapolis, then he is a guy to really watch and watch progress, because he has the ability to be a middle-of-the-order bat, and it's not many guys in the Sox system you can say that about.
And the final guy I wanted to focus on was the focus of actually our last Future Sox interview, and that's Kenekoa Tashira, the closer down in Kannapolis. The guy, he's just been putting up numbers ever since he got drafted. He's actually a native Hawaiian. He's from Honolulu, actually. He pitched at Saddleback Junior College, but for as good as you said Duane Day's slider is, people from Baseball America, notably Phil Rogers, say Tashira's slider is better, and the fact is he's just been getting guys out at ridiculous rates down in both Great Falls, I think it was last year, and Kannapolis, and I think this guy, he's probably second or third in the organization behind Day and Perez as far as the ability to advance in the White Sox organization, because he's got a good fastball that I believe sits in the low 90s, and he's got that unbelievable slider. I don't know if you've heard much about him, but of course you could read our own Future Sox interview and possibly learn a little more about him. But he seems like a guy who's got a good head on his shoulders, because he still feels he has to improve a lot to keep jumping the ladder.
Yeah, Teixeira, he was a very good draft pick of the White Sox, like you mentioned, Saddleback College, and that is an encouraging sign. I've never been able to see him pitch personally, and most of what I know is based on other people's reports in the case of Teixeira, whatever you want to call him. And when anyone says that you have a better slider than Duan Day, that right there is impressive if it's true. And, you know, I'll take it with a grain of salt when it comes from Baseball America a lot of times. But, you know, it's a good sign. The numbers put up, the whip, his ability out of the bullpen, and the Sox really are starting to get a lot of good relief candidates, and I think it's because Ken Williams knows the beauty of it. If you have young relief pitching that can come up, you can keep your payroll down and focus on putting your money in starting pitching, which is really where money should be, because it's a lot harder to get young players to come up and throw 7 consistent innings and get quality start after quality start out of them as starting pitching than it is to get young guys to come up and to have success and dominate out of a pen, because usually you're only out there for an inning, and it's just a little bit easier mindset, a little bit less of a grind on the player, and you just see a lot more relievers come up and have success immediately than you ever do starting pitchers. So I think that's the plan for the Sox organization, is to always have power arms they can bring up and kind of come in when your relief pitchers start to get to the point where they become free agents and get real expensive contracts, because if you want to pay for to have a good bullpen, it's going to cost you. I mean, look what the Angels had to pay for Scott Shields, Justin Spire, and they're going to be giving Frankie Rodriguez a good chunk of money as well. And if you're going to try to keep your budget in the $90-$100 million range and have a bat like Canerco, a bat like Tome, and have 3 or 4 pitchers that make $10 million a year, the only way you can have a full, consistent pitching staff is by having a lot of young talent to consistently bring up in the bullpen level. And the Sox that have in Teixeira, Texiera, Day, you have Boone Logan, you obviously have Matt Long and Omagrosso, two pretty high draft picks from last year that have power arms that really fit nice in the plans. And Matt Long's been doing stretch out as a starter. However, long term, he projects as a reliever. The Sox are just working on him developing additional pitches, which is real positive. The organization seems to be making a lot of strides in terms of how they're developing guys, and I'm real impressed with it. And I think the Sox are we're gonna see the benefit. It's reaped a few years from now at US Cellular Field when you have talent on the field. And you also see those benefits reaped when Ken Williams continues to pick and choose which guys he actually moves out to get other types of talents that maybe the organization doesn't have that has immediate need for.
I mean, you look at the Major League bullpen, and I think Mike McDougal is going to be our highest paid pitcher up there with between $2 and $3 million a year. But you look at Aridsma, who's going to be making league minimum, Cisco, league minimum, Massett, league minimum. Thornton, I think, just over $1 million, and I believe Jinx is still at league minimum. And if there's one place we can save money, it's there, because Kenny Williams obviously knew what he was doing in assembling our bullpen this year. Either that or he's just got a horseshoe stuck up his ass, because these guys have been outstanding so far. And if we can save money in the back end of our bullpen with guys we know who can still get the job done, it really does help so we can focus on other parts of the team.
Yeah, I completely agree. If you can keep that on the cheap and use your arms for 5 or 6 seasons, bring up guys consistently, you really can have a very good bullpen that stays strong for a long time. So that is the Future Sox Report. We're going to play you a little bit of music. I thank Alex for being back out here again to talk minor league baseball, because obviously Mario is worthless when it comes to minor league baseball. Mario will be back with me for the third segment. Alex, Mario, and I just want to repeat this kind of consistently over the show so people get the idea of what we're going to be doing. We're rarely going to have a 3-man booth. We're going to have oftentimes 2 of us in here at a time. Sometimes 2 will do the show all in full. Other times we're going to bring a third person in from an outside place, like a Minnesota Twins podcast or a Cleveland Indians podcast or a big blogger from somewhere else, and try to just really keep the show with consistent varying opinions, and we hope you're going to like it. And we're going to be back with the third segment, which is going to be a bit of a focus on the AL Central and the rest of baseball. Thanks for listening to us. And Alex, as always, great to have you here talking minor league baseball.
It's been fun for me too, and remember, Jason, go Cyclones.
Asshole. Welcome back. We hope you enjoyed that Future Sox moment. Now Mario and I are back. He was gone. He had his silence. Yeah. And we're going to talk a little bit about the AL Central. This is going to be kind of our show. We're going to have different segments, and we're going to stick with it. And we hope you like it. So I want to just first get this out. If you guys do have any comments, you have any segments you'd like us to see or discuss, or topics you'd like us to discuss, or things we can do better, make sure to shoot us an email at contact@futuresox.com. And remember to check out, because we're going to have our new site up there, the southsidereport.soxtalk.com. You can have archives to all our feeds if anyone actually wants to listen to us.
Make it a little bit easier. We'll have a flash player there so you can kind of just click on any show you want, and it'll start playing immediately. So maybe you want to watch it while you're listening to it while you're watching a Sox game, or while you're on Sox Talk, talking and or bitching about the Chicago White Sox,
or while you're having a conversation with your girlfriend. You know, you put us on. You hear our expert analysis. That you see her lips move, and you nod your head.
That could be a marketing angle we take. You know,
hey.
drowned out the voice of your girlfriend,
or
the ramblings of your or significant other. Oh, SOL.
Come on, we got to be after I'm a Scott fired. We got to be so PC. I mean, I'm afraid I'm gonna get fired for my comments about how the South Side of California is just rough from last week's show.
Yeah, I know you're in a rough neighborhood there. Let's get into the Sox are in a rough division, American League Central, and it's kind of going as planned. A lot of people expected where it's very, very close. The Twins and Tigers are in first place, followed by the Indians and White Sox, like a half a game or one game out. And it looks like this could very well be how it looks for a very, very long time until maybe one team separates themselves. And it's pretty exciting because even right now, even yesterday, I'm kind of looking and I'm like, oh, wow, the Tigers and the Twins lost. The Sox actually gained ground. Even though it's too short in the season, you still kind of, at least I have that mentality, sadly. You start with the Twins, though. Santana actually lost. We talked about him in the first segment. He actually lost his first, I think, home game since 2005. So what's typically an easy win for the Twins, they end up getting a loss with Santana. But overall, the Twins, they just keep on going. They just keep on going with obviously Santana and Morneau and Mauer and just all those, as Guillen says, piranhas.
They're playing good. And they also got a little bit of luck. I mean, I don't know if you saw Carl Crawford's fantastic base running, just the devil rays base running in general that kind of gave them that win.
I heard about that.
In Tampa Bay, that was ridiculous. But the Twins are playing well, and they've had a guy in Ramon Ortiz show up like the pitcher that I used to love when he was in Anaheim.
Yeah.
Back when he first came up and was just dominant. I mean, the guy three hit the Yankees. And who is this guy? He's just showing up. I mean, Sid Ponson is the usual Sid Ponson. Terrible. But I thought the Minnesota Twins are going to really be screwed when you're relying on Ponson and Ortiz. But so far, Ortiz has been good for him. They're winning. You have the Detroit Tigers that are playing well. Verlander's looking good. They're surviving without Ken Rogers. And if you can win without Ken Rogers, if they do end up getting him back, and as much as I don't think he'll do good, it'll be an addition. That'd be like making a trade.
Yeah.
You know, when you get a guy like Kent Rogers, a veteran, back in your rotation.
Even if guys like Verlander and Bonderman, even if they progress to where they take another step, a guy like Rogers no longer has to be an ace. He could be a fourth starter, and he could be a fairly decent fourth starter.
And then you have Cleveland, who, in between all their snow and playing home games.
Yeah. They haven't really had it too easy because they've had to go, of course, to Milwaukee to play the Seattle Mariners, and now they're actually playing in Cleveland. They actually had to change the Saturday game to 12 o'clock and because of weather. So the Indians have really been put in a tough situation because they haven't really been playing a lot of baseball. So who really knows how things are going to go for them, especially not only when they start playing every day. Obviously, their offensive players are going to get into more of a rhythm, but at the same time, their rotation and that bullpen could very well be exploited more because that bullpen, with the likes of Joe Borowski closing the door at the end of the games, that could be what kills, what dooms the Cleveland Indians at the end of the day.
Yeah, we discussed it last week's show when I picked the Indians, and the reality is that bullpen is still terrible. I know they made a lot of signings, but that bullpen's still bad, and I was wrong. I'm willing to admit it a week into the season about the fact that I said that bullpen had been improved. It's still pretty damn terrible, so they're going to have to find some arms or hope their bats and starters
And really, offensively, you kind of like – I've always liked David DeLucci. I've always liked Trot Nixon, so I like the fact that they added these two guys, although they're both lefties, so you kind of wonder, you know, how many lefties they actually want to have in that lineup. But Grady Sizemore, by far probably the most favorite player in baseball, at least as far as I'm concerned, watching. Just I enjoy watching him. Obviously, Travis Hefner is just is an absolute monster. So offensively, they're going to have to carry that team. And the pitching staff, the rotation, they have some things to work with. And then there's the Kansas City Royals, who kind of just bring up the rear in last place. And it's kind of sad because even if they do make progress this year with some of the young guys and even guys like Zach Greinke, who makes that comeback, He pitched well in his first start. I think he faced the great Matsuzaka.
Yeah.
And he pitched very well. And I think his second start, I forgot who he played, but he actually had another good start. So Zach Greinke might actually be living up to the potential that he had when he first jumped on the scene with the Royals.
And it's good to see, because he pretty much had a complete breakdown after that first year where he got rushed up to the majors. He just couldn't handle it. Went and thought about playing in the PGA. I know we had some laughs about it when it happened. Yeah. And it's good to see him up there and pitching better. And I like to see our division play well.
Yeah.
And this division is going to be something to watch. It's going to be better, a better race than it was last year. It is going to be as good of a race as I can ever imagine in a division since they've changed to the new format of three divisions in each league. It is going to be exciting all the way down to the wire.
Yeah, especially, and I think it says a lot, because the Cleveland Indians, I think they're going to be playing better than they did last year, and I think that's just going to combine it all. And, of course, the Royals, while they're still not a great team, they'll probably be a little bit better to where they could at least maybe win a few more games and make things really, really close for down the stretch. Let's wrap this show up so we can get the hell out of here. We get the show up and get out of here. But there is other things going around in Chicago sports, namely the Chicago Bulls, the number 2 seed Chicago Bulls.
Currently rated number 2. They had a big win against the Charlotte Bobcats last night. They're going to have 2 more key games, and they got to win them. I mean, let's be honest. If they win out, then they're for sure going to be the 2 seed. If they lose a game, then they have to hope that Cleveland loses a game, and Cleveland has an easier schedule to finish off the final 2 games. And it's big to get that 2 seed, because it means you have Miami, Detroit, and Cleveland all on the other side on the road to the Eastern Conference Finals. And that's big, because while Toronto is a good team, and they're playing good even when RJ Barnagna was down for a while and they had some injuries, and it'd be huge for the Bulls to get there. And this is where it matters. This is why they signed Ben Wallace. It's to win in the postseason. It's time. The Bulls have gotten here twice. It's no longer, yay, we made the playoffs. It's now what are you going to do now that you're there?
They have to go deep and not even necessarily win the championship, but they at least have to get, I'm thinking, you know, the second round would be something you could settle for, but you'd like to see them get to that third round.
Yeah, I think Eastern Conference Finals or bust is the ultimate goal. And from there, you never know what can happen, because this team is capable of coming out of the East. There's no doubt about it. When you play the defense they do, when you have the low post presence of Ben Wallace defensively, his veteran leadership.
The emergence of a Tyrus Thomas, the return of a Nocioni.
Yeah, things are starting to fill in. I just hope that Nocioni can get enough action to where he's ready, because he's going to be rusty through that first round of the playoffs.
Well,
so hopefully he can carry through there and then really bring a spark in the second round.
He was talking about it. He pretty much feels that he's going to be able to put up maybe 15, 20 minutes a night tops, just because he's feels fatigued. So, but really, they've been playing so well without him, they may not need him to play the 30, 40 minutes. Maybe if he just comes in and gives that nice big boost for a 10, 15-minute period, that could be all they need. But we're going to leave all the Bulls talking to Bulls Chat with Matt Kolsky and Matt and Joe, and let them kind of handle all the Bulls discussion. They could actually listen to them on TalkBulls.com, yes?
Yes, they can. Talk Bulls, they have a new cast up. It went up about 2 days ago, so check them out. They have a very good show. They are way more responsible than we are. But we're going to have a little battle, because we're going to be pretty consistent ourselves since the season rolls on.
Let's talk about it again. You brought it up in the Future Sox segment. We're going to try to, in an attempt to try to really make the show consistent and as best as we can, and trying to fill it with as many opinions, we're going to try to mix this show up. It's not always just going to be me and Jason talking, or Jason and Alex talking. We're going to try to get some other guys in. I know we actually, when we posted the last show in Sox Talk, we had somebody who expressed interest in getting in on the show. So, people on Sox Talk, some of the posters, if they want to come on and give their opinions, especially if they think we're not doing a very good job, they're more than welcome to do it. If you got a blogger who wants to come on, whether from the Twins, the Indians, or from the White Sox, we're going to have these guys on. We're going to mix it in. We're going to mix in the rotation. And just for the simple fact to try to get as many shows out as we can, because it's very tough with my schedule, with your schedule, for us to really produce a show every single week.
Yeah, and we hope that you guys enjoy these shows, because you know what? We have a lot of fun doing it. And I think if no one listened, we'd probably still do it.
Yeah.
Hell, I don't know if people do listen. But you know what? As long as Greasy and Ian, Mr. Show, they listen, then you know what? I'll be happy. I'll be happy. I mean, someone else other than us is listening to our shows. But we hope more of you listen. And if you do enjoy us, or if you think we're the biggest idiots, douchebags in the world, tell your friends to listen to us and laugh at us. I don't care. If you guys get entertained, we're happy.
That's all that matters. We're doing this for you and for us, but more for us than you. I hate people.
It's true. Damn people.
We'll see you next time.
But yeah, check out Talk Bulls, Talk Bears, StocksTalk.com, FutureStocks.com, and whatever the hell other baseball site you visit or wherever else you go on the web. Have a good one. We'll be back next week.